the schedule or something. But anyway. So yesterday, I gave like a very broad overview of the whole idea behind the landscape. I introduced the ideas of Busso and Polchinski. And at the end, I noted that the main shortcoming of their approach was that they just, you know, completely freeze the moduli and let only the fluxes vary. Of course, that's the wrong thing to do, because when you pick a certain flux, it will induce a potential for the moduli, so they will adjust themselves according to these fluxes, and you get a much more complicated coupled system. Okay. Now, so today, then, we're going to see how to treat the problem, including a moduli. And also today, I will focus more on, especially in the second part of the lecture, more on really technical computational tools, whereas yesterday was perhaps more philosophical. Today, I'll try to teach you some techniques, or at least show how concrete computations are done in this framework. So, but anyway, so the reason why Busso and Polchinski didn't consider moduli stabilization is largely probably because it was not very well understood at the time. That changed, actually, with the paper of Kaczu, Gawaslin, and Trivedi. And so I'll first, in the first part of the lecture, talk about that. So, the setting these people start is type 2B string theory on the Calabi-Yau tree orientifold. So this is n equals 1 supersymmetry in 4 dimensions. And so in a, well, a Calabi-Yau orientifold is just some Calabi-Yau manifolds modeled out by Z2 geometrical involution that also acts by inverting the orientation of the string world sheet. And, well, there are various beasts living in these compactifications, so in particular, you always will get, at least for the ones that we will consider today, you get O3 and O7 planes. So these are the fixed point sets of the Z2 involution of the orientifold. They're always space filling. Now they induce certain D3 and D7 brain charges, which have to be canceled. Otherwise, you get tadpoles. So that means that automatically you also have D3 brains present and D7 brains. That's a good thing because you want eventually to get gauge theories, non-abelian gauge theories, of course, and they live naturally on these D brains. Okay. Now, the big problem with these compactifications a priori is that they have a lot of moduli. As I emphasized yesterday, we don't want those. So which moduli do we have? Well, the H, so if you call the Calabi-Yau manifold X, then we have H to 1 of X complex structure moduli. Try to shape deformations of the Calabi-Yau manifold. They're H11 of X, Kähler moduli. are size moduli, if you want, more concretely. They're measured by volumes of force cycles. And finally, there's all this one more massless field, and or complex massless field, and that's the combination of the type 2B axion and the dilaton, which holomorphically combine the chiral field tau given by the axion plus I over G string e to the phi. Okay. So all these guys a priori are massless. Yeah. Now we want to give them masses. So how can we do that? Well, there are several ingredients that go in this KKLT construction. First thing you do is you turn on fluxes. So probably have heard quite a bit already about those in the school, the lectures of Katrin Becker, for example. So concretely, what do we have in type 2B here? Well, we have RR fluxes, RR three-form flux in particular. And NSNS three-form flux, H3. Okay. Now these guys couple to the complex structure moduli and to the dilaton, and they will generate a potential for those, and generically would actually give all both the complex structure moduli and the dilaton masses. So more concretely, how does it work? Well, there is a superpotential induced by these fluxes, simply given by integral of F3 minus tau H3, which omega, where omega, so this integral is over the Calabi-Yau manifolds X, right? And this is the holomorphic tree form on the Calabi-Yau. So you can write this more, you know, more down to earth way, perhaps, again, by decomposing both fluxes and this holomorphic tree form in a basis of integral harmonic forms. So you pick a basis, sigma alpha, this is H3 of X, Z, if you want. You write F equals N alpha, sigma alpha, H, M alpha, sigma alpha. So N and M are integral vectors. And then this can be rewritten as N alpha minus tau M alpha times, well, the contraction of sigma alpha with omega, and that integrated, which is nothing but a so-called period integral. So you can reinterpret this as the integral of omega 3 over the 3-cycle Poincaré dual to sigma a. Yeah. And that just gives you then a vector of functions depending on the complex structure moduli, which you will denote by pi alpha. So this is a period vector. The Calabi-Yau depends on the complex structure moduli. Okay. So you see the dependencies on the dilaton on the complex structures. Yeah. Why the forms have to be closed? F, you mean? And F follows from the equations of motion. More precisely, yeah. So, well, there's subtlety with the warping, but these forms are conformal to three forms, indeed, that that are closed. I mean, they're harmonic. Well, they're obviously closed, actually, because they're just locally. F is D of C2, and H3 is D of B2, locally. So they're definitely closed. Not in this case. This is really all there is. All right. Now, that's actually the nice thing about type 2B is that everything is really nicely closed, and you can actually really do this stuff. So, okay. So this then will induce, as usual, a potential, which because of the four-dimensional n equals one supersymmetry has the following form. So dAw b bar w bar. Minus 3 W square, where K here, K is a Gaylor potential. Which depends in a non-holomorphic way on all the moduli. And then these Ds, capital VA, are Gaylor covariant derivatives, which means it's partial derivative. Plus dAk. Okay. This acting on top of you. So you see this generic case. This will be a very complicated function, a very generic function. So you expect indeed that this will leave no flat directions for the complex and complex vector moduli and the dilaton. Okay. Yeah. Sorry? A phi form? Yeah, there is a phi form, but, well, we cannot use a phi form, for example, to construct something like this, because on a genuine Calabi-Yau threefold, there are no non-trivial, H5 is zero. So there are no cohomologically non-trivial phi forms. It does play a role, though. So it doesn't mean the phi form is actually a zero in these compactifications, because the phi form is, it's sourced by D3 brain charge, and there will be D3 brain charges all around, so both from D3 and O3 planes, as well as actually induced by these F and H fluxes, right? Oh, yeah, that's something important that I forgot to mention, actually. So these fluxes are not arbitrary. There's an important tadpole constraint on them. The tadpole constraint just says that the total D3 brain charge has to be zero, right? Which is the total space-filling D3 brain charge. Has to be zero. So what are the contributions to this total D3 brain charge? Well, obviously, you get a contribution from the D3 brains themselves. But then you also get a contribution from the fluxes. So they induce a D3 brain charge given by this topological number, which, if you want, you can rewrite using this expansion as and alpha and beta times right, where this is an anti-symmetric symplectic form given by the intersection products of these cycles. So this plus this minus then the minus contributions from, and these are lumped together from O3 planes, from curvature on these 7 brains, and that's about it, yeah. So this gives a negative contribution, and this is sort of, well, fixed by the compactification. Yeah. For which, for these, there's no source, so these are just background fluxes. They don't need any sources. So that's, you can do that because there exist indeed non-trivial harmonic tree forms on the Calabi-Yau, and therefore these things can just be there, satisfy the equations of motion, be non-trivial, and have no sources. For the phi form, you can do that. That's why, you know, you need the three sources to get a non-zero phi form. So all this stuff, you know, you can compute it either directly in type 2b. There is also a more elegant way of doing it by lifting this construction to F theory. I didn't mention that. I might say something about that later on. But so this whole construction is dual to F theory on an elliptically fibered Calabi-Yau fourfold, or to M theory on the same fourfold in a certain limit. In that framework, you can nicely compute this thing as being the order characteristic of this fourfold divided by 24. But it's not necessary for this discussion. In principle, you can also compute it from here. So it can be a bit more specific, actually. So an O3 plane will contribute minus 1/4 units of the 3-brain charge, each O3. And then the curvature of these 7 brains, they will give a contribution equal to minus the Euler characteristic of the 7 brains divided by 24. That at least is the case if the 7 brains are not intersecting. If they're intersecting, then it gets like more messy. But okay. So now the big problem are, of course, the Kähler moduli, because as you can see, you know, they don't appear anywhere in the classical superpotential. And in fact, indeed, it turns out that, well, they do appear in the Kähler potential, but if you look more closely, you find that they're, in fact, classically not fixed at all. So they're completely flat directions. However, quantum mechanically, since it's an n equals 1 theory, various things can happen. And in particular, it will get non-perturbative contributions to the superpotential, which do depend on Kähler moduli. So this is classically not fixed. But so there are non-perturbative effects. One of them is given by the three instantons wrapping 4 cycles. Okay, so Euclidean D3 brain instanton, of course, is 4-dimensional, wraps on 4 cycle. And that will give a contribution under certain circumstances to the potential, to the superpotential, sorry, the form E to the minus E plus I integral of C4, right? where V is the volume of the fourth cycle, and this integral of the RR potential C4 is again over the fourth cycle. Okay. So you see this is indeed dependent on the Kirov moduli. This guy here, this coefficient depends on can depend on the complex structure moduli and on the Dirac potential as well. Second effect is that on the D7 brains, so if you have coincident D7 brains and you don't have too much matter living on them, then you can get gauge Zeno condensation in the corresponding low energy effective gauge theory. So okay, now these seven brains, again, wrap, also they fill space-time, but they also wrap four cycles, right? So, and the size of these four cycles will determine the coupling constant in the gauge theory. And in that way, it will affect the contribution of this gauge Zeno condensate to the superpotential. So more precisely, again, you get the contribution to the superpotential, which is of the form, again, some coefficients, times minus, and then so very similar to what you had for the D3 instanton, again, volume, complexified volume of the wrapped four cycle by the seven brain. There's an additional coefficient here, which depends on the rank, which depends on the rank of the gauge group for SU, and it would be just 1/n. For SO8, it would be 1/6, and so on. Okay. No, so this, the coefficient B in general is actually very hard to compute. It's given by, well, in this case, for example, it's given by some determinant that's, well, pretty hard to compute. But the good thing is actually that in the end, things don't depend very much or hardly at all on the precise functional dependence of this B. Sorry? No. No. So, at least not in in this type 2B setup. Right. So, the at least not a contribution to the superpotential. So I guess one way of seeing it would be that a so a wrap, so that would be Euclidean D1 brain wrapping two cycle, but that's not going to preserve the same supersymmetry as the background. So if you want the phase of the preserved supersymmetry of the center, well. Right. Well, let's stick to that. If you won't preserve the same supersymmetry as the background, so supersymmetry is broken, and you won't supersymmetry is completely broken, and you won't get a contribution to the superpotential. Another way of seeing it is there is just no holomorphic coordinates that would correspond. So a good holomorphic coordinate that would correspond to the two cycles. So you might say, well, why don't you get something like e to the I, the volume of the two cycle, complexified then, say, by integral of I of b2 or maybe c2. Well, you already see there's some ambiguity here. Should I take b2 or c2? That already smells fishy, but the thing is, actually, these things are even not there because they are projected out by the Yonti folding. That, again, is related to the fact that, you know, it's an incompatibility of supersymmetries and so on. So yes is no. In this case, not. However, they may contribute to the Kähler potential. So there, you know, you don't get these holomorphicity constraints, and basically anything can happen. That if we turn on these fluxes, well, so we know that, for example, from papers by Giddings, Katcher, and Polchinski, and Katrin Becker, and so on. So in many settings like type 2A and so on, once you turn on fluxes, you know, well, the Calabi-R is, you know, not at all Calabi-R. You completely lose the Calabi-R condition. But it turns out in type 2B that the metric actually, well, it does not stay Calabi-R, but it stays conformal Calabi-R. So the only thing that happens is some rescaling, some warping of the metric. But it does remain conformal Calabi-R, at least in the classical approximation. Now, at first sight, you would say, oh, well, this gives an enormous amount of contributions, right? Because, I mean, there's a gigantic number of four cycles in a typical Calabi-R, so you would think you get this enormous number of contributions. But actually, there are pretty strong constraints on which four cycles can contribute. And the reason is that these things can only, so Euclidean determinants can only contribute if they have exactly two fermion zero modes. Right? So why is that? Well, it's because the superpotential in the action computes couplings, the IDJ, W. To these fermion bilinears, right? So well, these two here correspond to these two fermion zero modes that have to be soaked up. So that actually, well, definitely in the absence of fluxes, turns out to give pretty strong constraints on these three cycles, which, I'm sorry, on these four cycles, which again is most elegantly formulated when lifting this thing to M theory. But let me not get into that. Sufficiently to say that this is a strong constraint. Now, if in the presence of fluxes, actually things get better because, well, basically, the reason why this is hard to satisfy in the absence of fluxes is simply because the typical four cycle, the typical divisor in a Calabi-R comes with many deformation moduli. Like, for example, if you define the four cycle by a single algebraic equation, well, then you can change the coefficients of this equation, and that gives you deformation moduli. So you get massless bosonic moduli, and by supersymmetry, you also expect to get them massless fermions, so fermionic zero modes. And so 2 is the absolute minimum, so anything you've got on top of that will destroy the contribution of the four cycle. However, if you turn on fluxes, it turns out that these deformation moduli get constrained, and you can also show that, as you expect from supersymmetry, that a lot of these fermion zero modes get eliminated, and you do, in fact, get more contributions. Okay. Now, okay, so everything together here, all these things together. In principle, if you do get enough contributions, so in principle, this gives. So this is sufficient then to also stabilize the Kähler moduli. Right? Because you get now the total superpotential that is of the form W flux plus and this series of non-perturbative contributions. These are the Kähler moduli. Okay. Okay, now, so the more concretely, now you want to really establish that this is the case. So, which vacua are the best under control? Well, those are supersymmetric vacua, of course. And these are solutions of. These are solutions of D A W equals zero, where A runs over all the moduli. And D of A is again the covariance derivative. Oh yeah, I didn't say what K is, so K is minus the logarithm of the volume, which depends on the Kähler moduli, minus the logarithm of the integral of omega, which omega bar, which you can write in terms of these periods pi alpha. So this is the equation you have to solve. Now, if you find solutions of that, you're still not entirely confident that you really have shown that there are stabilized vacua, because all this is derived in some geometrical approximation, right? So in order to trust that, you want that the divisor volumes and so on are sufficiently large, right? So these guys here, these volumes must be sufficiently large. So that means that these e to the minus rho i's have to be very small, really very small. That in turn implies that in order to still find solutions to this, that also this first term, W flux, has to be very small. It's not perhaps entirely obvious at first sight, but if you look a little bit closer, you will see that you'll have to balance off this part to this part, and to balance them off, they have to be of the same order. So therefore, if this is much smaller than one, you also get a W flux. Has to be much smaller than one. Now, generically, this is not going to be the case, right? Because this flux superpotential is composed of these periods of integer fluxes. These are generically big numbers. So, generically, W flux would actually be bigger than one. However, very similar to this Busso-Polchinski idea, because there are so many fluxes and so many contributions, you can actually get cancellations, and you can get to very small values of W flux for a very small fraction of all the fluxes. But if you, start with a huge amount, that's still a huge amount of fluxes in absolute terms, right? So how does this work? So recall that this looks like n alpha plus tau m alpha I alpha. So you see, by taking various combinations of these n's and m's, you can get cancellations in here, and you can get this very small. Okay. So using actually the statistical techniques that I'm going to describe in the second part of the lecture, you can show that for a fraction of order, say for a fraction for the lambda star, we get that W flux squared is less than lambda star. Okay, so for if you want W flux squared to be less than 10 to the minus 100, well, then you'll get a fraction 10 to the minus 100, for which this is the case. Now you might say, well, will you have anything left at all? Well, this, of course, depends on the total number of flux fabia that you have. And that's also something we will compute using these statistical methods. And it turns out, indeed, that in many cases, you get like 10 to the 200, 10 to the 300, and so on. So more than enough to actually realize this. Okay. Okay. So for many still, you get that this is satisfied, provided there are enough fluxes. When they are not satisfied? So, you mean when this is not much smaller than one? Well, so then, so if W flux is of order one, and you try to solve this, then you'll find, well, you may find solutions, but these e to the minus rows will also be of order one. So that means that the volumes of these devices will be very small, right? So e to the minus rho of order one means rho is like near zero. So that means the volume of these devices is near zero. And it means that the whole size of the Clausius manifold is extremely small. And these things have been derived. So this flux superpotential, the Kehler potential that has been used, all these things have been derived from classical geometry. And so in the regime where these volumes become very small, you expect very important quantum corrections, which are not computable at this point. So it doesn't mean that there are no vacua. Probably there are. And so the majority of vacua will just unfortunately be out of our control. But the achievement of KKLT is actually to really propose this construction in a controlled regime. Okay. So that was their proposal, their construction. They didn't give concrete examples. It took quite some time to find concrete examples, probably not because they're rare, but just because technically, you know, it's a lot of work to really show that these things contribute, that the right topological conditions are satisfied. Then you get like some complicated potential. You have to find its critical points. Again, this is, you know, a problem that gets surprisingly hard when the number of moduli grows and so on. So technically, it's just a pain in the ass to do all this. But it can be done. And so by now, this for supersymmetric fabia is pretty well established. Okay. So all this to convince you of the fact that this landscape at least exists. Now we want to do some statistics, for example, to establish these things. And so as you can see from this whole construction, the main source of degeneracy of vacua, or multiplicity of vacua, will come from the flux sector, from the fact that you can choose many fluxes, right? So you could also get many. For a given flux, you could also get several critical points, but you will never get a gigantic amount. So the main part of the multiplicity comes from the flux sector, and therefore the complex structure and the Dilaton sector. So what we are going to do to make life a bit easier is just, for that reason, ignore the Kähler moduli altogether. Just look at the complex structure moduli and the flux potential and count critical points of that one. Right. Then in the second step, you could stabilize the Kähler moduli, but that will generically be fine, even if you're outside of a controlled regime. And if you insist on being in a controlled regime, you can just restrict to the subset of the fluxes for which this is satisfied. Yeah? Yeah, that's in part from experience, but let's see. Well, okay, wait a minute. So the multiplicity of solutions in the complex structure moduli space, that we will take into account. Yeah. The only thing that we will ignore is the multiplicity that you might get in the Kähler sector. Now, right. So at least for very small W, you'll get essentially decoupling of the two sectors. So you can first stabilize a complex structure moduli. If this is very small, then you can in that step forget about the Kähler moduli, and then look in the second step to that sector, treating this first part just as a constant, as a very small constant, and then you go on and you solve this. So that in particular means that, at least in that regime, the only thing the Kähler moduli need to know about complex structure moduli is this value of W flux, right? So as long as you stay in that regime, there may come a big multiplicity still from this part, but it will be a constant, just some constant factor. It will not be correlated with it will affect the total number, but it will not affect, for example, the distributions over the complex structure moduli space, because those will turn out to be uncorrelated to the value of W, and therefore they will be uncorrelated to the Kähler moduli. Anyway, that's all we'll do. Of course, the real motivation is because it's otherwise essentially impossible to derive nice results. But so the nice thing about the complex structure sector and flux sector is that there's a structure of special geometry, and that allows actually to simplify a lot of the calculations that otherwise might be infeasible. This brings us to the second part. Okay. So we will start by counting supersymmetric vacua of the flux superpotential. So this is characterized then by choice of a flux vector and alpha, m alpha. Yeah. So this was F3 extreme. And then for each of these fluxes, critical points of W, right? So more precisely, the solution to DIW, which then depends on N and M, tau z equals 0. So you want to count those. More precisely, so if you look at the region S in the parameter space, moduli space, let's say, a moduli space that's parametrized by Z and by tau. So you have some region S. So you expect many flux factor in there. And so the task we want to, or what we want to achieve, is actually to find some approximate counting formula for the number of flux factor inside that region. So let's first consider the simplest case. Would be if you have some rigid Calabi-Yau, which means no complex structure moduli. So there's only this axiom Dirac modulus tau. Yeah. So in that case, well, a rigid Calabi-Yau has B3 equals 2. So that means you can turn on two RR fluxes and two NSNS fluxes. It's in total 4. And superpotential will therefore be of the form, let's say, F1 plus IF2. So these are the two RR fluxes. Yeah, these are integers, minus tile H1 plus IH2. These are the two NSNS flux quantum numbers. Now the tadpole, the D3 tadpole cancellation condition in this case would be F1 H2 minus H1, so this is antisymmetric bilinear of the fluxes. This, so this would have to be, this thing plus the number of D3 brains has to be less than some, has to be equal to some number L star, which is given by the compactification, right? There was this contribution to the D3 brain charge from O3 planes, D7 brains, curvature, and so on, right? So for supersymmetric vacua, this is always a positive number, number of D3 brains. Yeah? So they just float around. We don't, and for our purposes, not particularly interesting further. So the, because this is bigger than zero, the in the end, the constraint that we have on this here is that that has to be less than or equal to L star, right? L star is some given number. We won't specify this for this problem. But that's the constraint. So in this case, you can actually solve the equations d tau w equals 0 exactly. It's easy to work out. So d tau of w is, well, you'll manage to compute it yourself, no doubt. So you get tau equal to minus F1 minus IF2, H1 minus IH2. Yeah. Oh, maybe I should have told you then what the Kehler potential is. Kehler potential in this case is minus logarithm of minus I tau minus tau bar. And this d of tau, as always, partial tau plus then d tau of k. So you work this out. You know, you get some combinations of taus and tau bars. You plug it in. You get some linear equation, and you just solve by this thing. OK. So a priori, actually, you get an infinite number of solutions, right? Because this here is an indefinite form, so it's not positive definite. So it's an infinite number of combinations that satisfy this constraint. And, well, just plug all of them in here, and so for each of them you do get a solution. So you say, what's going on? Well, of course, you've forgotten one thing, and that is that there's such a thing as duality. And so what you really have to do is you have to restrict tau to its fundamental domain, because if you land outside of it, well, the solution will be dual to a solution inside the fundamental domain. Right? So if you look at the tau plane, this keyhole region, which is the fundamental domain. So what you really have to do is find solutions that end up in here. Now, it's still not clear that that will give you a finite number for a finite L star, but that turns out to be the case. And so you can actually do this exactly, you know, using a computer. You can enumerate these things exactly. And for example, for L star equals 150, you find for the total number of vacua in this fundamental domain, you find 37,208, for example. So now our challenge is, on the one hand, to understand, well, perhaps to understand why is this number finite. You know, it's not very clear that it should be. And then to try to reproduce this number using some approximate techniques. So okay, so in this particular model that I mean, you shouldn't take this too seriously, so I'm not even sure you can, that you do get a good type 2B example based on a rigid Clavier that you then still have to orient default and so on. So in this case at hand, it's just, you know, a toy model and you can take any L star you want. In more realistic models, L star will be given by the compactification. So there's, you know, various ways to compute it. The typical value of L star is, you know, order 100 or something, 200. If you lift this construction to M theory, then L star has a very simple geometrical description. It's simply equal to the order characteristic of the Clavier fourfold divided by 24. Okay, well, the total number of vacua, let's say the number of vacua in a region S of the tau plane is given by the following exact expression. It's given by the sum over all these fluxes F and H that satisfy condition F1H2 minus F2H1 is less than L star. You only have to sum over all of those. Times then, for each of them, the number of solutions to dw equals 0. So how can you write it down formally? Well, you write it down by integrating over the region S. So you want the number of solutions in S, of course. You integrate over S. Delta function d tau w, right? So it's delta dw bar. But then you're not done yet, because if you write in this way, the zeros of dw, well, you won't pick up a 1 for each of them. So what you actually have to do is you have to multiply this by the determinant of all possible derivatives of dw and d bar w bar. So that's d tau bar, w bar, d tau bar, w, and d tau bar, w bar. And so why, well, where does this come from? This is actually analogous to the simple case. So say if I have a function of one variable, I have a x function of one variable, and I want to compute the number of zeros of that function, well, or I want to write an expression for that, well, that's given by integral of delta of f of x times an absolute value of f prime of x. So this ensures that each of these solutions contributes plus one to this integral. Yeah. So the analog of that is this term. This is Jacobian of change of variable. Okay. Now, in fact, I should write, prior, I should write partial tau of these things, but you can replace it by covariant derivatives because what it acts on, the d tau of w, is zero anyway at the points where contributions get picked up. So I can, since a covariant derivative differs from an ordinary derivative by algebraic terms, I can just make that replacement. So these covariant derivatives actually are both Kähler covariant and also they involve the Levi-Civita connection. You know, they're like full covariant derivatives. So you might say, well, why do you do that? Life becomes, doesn't life become harder that way? Well, perhaps for this toy problem, it would be easier not to do that, but this then generalizes to the case with many moduli, and as you know, or should know from computation in general relativity, it's always much more powerful and easy in the end to compute with covariant derivatives than with non-covariant ones. So that's the reason. The formulas you get are much prettier. Well, when the determinant vanishes, that means that that you have flat directions. Yeah. And so that means not all the moduli are stabilized, and you don't want a counterfactual anyway. Now, on the other hand, that's perhaps a little bit well, no, let's stick to that. Okay. Now, what are these things? Well, I'm not going to work out the details, so you can try that yourself. But it turns out that d tau w is simply zero, and d tau of d. So that's really particular to this rigid case. D tau bar w bar, well, that you can write as the commutator of d tau bar of w bar, because the holomorphic derivative of w bar, covariant derivative, is zero. And then the commutator of d tau and d tau bar, well, is given by the curvature of the connection, right? And so the connection itself is given by the derivative of the Kähler potential, right? So the curvature of it is given by d bar d of the Kähler potential, and that's of course nothing but the metric, right? So you get g tau tau bar w bar. So you get a fairly simple determinant. This is zero, this is zero, this is w bar, this is w. So that simply gives you w squared. Yeah. Oh, sorry, times, of course, g tau tau bar squared. So now it's also convenient actually to switch to orthonormal frame coordinates, right? So actually. So this D here involves some change of variables to an orthonormal frame. That just has the effect of soaking up one of these metric factors. That's just a technical detail. So now, well, I guess we're getting to the point now. So the main approximation that we're going to make is to replace the sum over f and h here by an integral over f and h. So remember, that's actually very similar to what we did in Busa-Polchinski case, right, where we a priori had this sum over the lattice, which we then replaced by computing the volume. So that's just essentially replacing by the sum, the replacement of the sum by an integral, right? And let's also replace, well, switch these two guys here. So we'll get integral d squared f d squared h. Now, there are various ways of solving that, but the one that's most useful for generalization is the following. So note, okay, so integrate over tau here, right? But this, in this integral, tau is just some fixed number, right? And now you see that the integrand only depends on dw and on w, right? And each of these, so both dw and w depend linearly on these fluxes f and h, right? So a good thing to do is to just change variables from f and h to dw and w. So you do a change of variables. F1, F2, H1, H2, which are elements in R4, to W, which is just W, evaluate tau, right? So and F, let's call it F, which is dW evaluated at tau. So both of these things depend linearly on F1, on F and H, right? So this is just a linear change of variables, okay? So there's no problem doing that. I'll spare you the details, but the nice thing of this change of variables is that the Jacobian is just a constant, it's 4. Well, it had to be a constant because, no, sorry, it didn't have to be a constant. That's surprising. So it's 4. And also this anti-symmetric bilinear, F1, H2 minus F2, H1, actually gets a very nice form in terms of these coordinates. It's just W squared minus F squared. I'm a bit sloppy here with factors e to the k and those things, but this would just give the general idea, right? So these are really very natural variables as well. All physically relevant quantities have some nice expression in terms of them. And, well, that implies that the integral over there simplifies tremendously. So you get the number, approximate number of vacua. Metric times and over W over F of delta F W squared. Okay. So this is, of course, a very elementary integral. You integrate out F just by putting F equal to 0. And so now you see something interesting happens, right? So before, remember this F1H2 minus F2H1. So this is an indefinite form. It's not positive definite, which gets, well, manifests here. You get W squared minus F squared. But now by imposing supersymmetry, you put this F equal to 0, and you effectively get something that is positive definite. And that, in the end, will explain the finiteness of the number of supersymmetric vacua that you get. So and this, of course, is a simple computation and gives you 2 pi L star squared times integral over S of E squared tau to 2 bar. This is, of course, nothing but the volume of S. Okay. So with respect to the natural metric on moduli space, you find that in this approximation, vacua are just uniformly distributed over the fundamental domain. So let's compare this to this exact result that I mentioned earlier. So for the total number of vacua, you have to so you get 2 pi L star squared times the area of the fundamental domain, right? With respect to the metric of G tau tau is 1 over 4 imaginary part of tau squared, which was directly from the Cayley potential that I gave earlier. So you can just do this integral, it's not too hard, and you find that this equals pi over 12. And so you get pi squared L star squared over 6. So plugging in L star equals to a 150, for which we had an exact, we had 37,208. Well, if you plug that in this formula, L star equals 150, you get a continuous approximation, 37,011. So that's just a 0.5% error, which is fairly good. Another easy thing that follows from this is distribution of, well, of course, of string coupling constants, because that's what it gives. And this is actually a fact that, well, remains true in more general settings as well. So the number of vacua with string coupling constants less than some G star, well, that's the same as the number of vacua with imaginary part of tau, which is 1 over G string. Bigger than 1 over G star, right? So that is 2 pi, well, okay. That's proportional to the area of the part of the fundamental domain above 1 over G star. And so that is just D. This is proportional to D imaginary part of tau over in tau squared going from 1 over g star to infinity. And that is just g star. So in other words, the distribution of g string is uniform. Yeah. For g string bigger than 1. And this actually remains true in the general case as well. So the upshot is, if you have a total number of actual n, then you can expect to get string coupling constants as low as 1 over n. Okay. Right. Yeah, that's right. The larger L star gets, the better the approximation. And also, you actually, you know, have to take this domain S. You cannot take it too small, obviously, because then you start seeing the discreteness of the distribution. So the actual distribution, you can plot this in the fundamental domain, and you get this incredibly pretty fractal structure with many holes and this and that. So from that, of course, you see that you can take this region as too small. So this then can be generalized to to find distributions of supersymmetric vacua in general to B case with an arbitrary number of complex structure moduli. You can also find distributions of cosmological constants, supersymmetric cosmological constants, right, which are minus 3 e to the k w squared. You find that these cosmological constants are actually, for small values, so near 0, again, uniformly distributed. So that, again, means that if you have n vacua in total, then the smallest cosmological constant, supersymmetric cosmological constant that you can get is of the order of 1 over m. So again, if there are many vacua, you can get very small cosmological constants. Right. You can also find distributions of scalar masses. Right, so these moduli get fixed. That means they get masses, and you can actually compute distribution of the masses. In particular, you can find out what fraction of all vacua has a mass matrix that is positive definite. It means that after, say, lifting to the sitter, you won't get any vacuons, at least not naively. Yeah. Of course, for a supersymmetric critical point, that doesn't matter. So even if the scalar masses squares are negative, it will still be stable, right? Because you get ADS, and then there's a Brayton-Noether Friedmann bound that that replaces the usual stability conditions. So for the Suzy vacuum, that doesn't really matter. But for uplifting to the sitter, for example, that does. And so you can find, you know, there's a certain fraction always, not too small, that indeed has a positive definite mass matrix. And finally, you can play the same game for a distribution of non-supersymmetric vacuum, and in particular, a distribution of supersymmetric grading scales. So that in analysis is already rather involved, but you get one, well, let me just mention the results. So you do get that So for F breaking, for F supersymmetry breaking vacua, you get a distribution of Susie breaking scales goes like Dn, M Susie to the tenth. So that means that, and so this is universal. It's for a sufficient number of moduli, at least, you get this result. It means that higher supersymmetry breaking scales are favored by flux vacua. Okay. Okay, so I think there's 10 minutes or 15 minutes left. Well, yeah, that's a good question, and I hope to, you know, get to the precise dependence. But yeah, there is some dependence, but I'll make this explicit. So there's one actually very beautiful formula that came out of this, and I'll try to sketch you. And so that formula can be derived very elegantly and very generally in general F-theory compactifications. It involves some pretty nifty tricks. I won't, of course, go through all the details, but I'll try to squeeze in 10 minutes the idea of the computation and then give the result. So, okay, so what we're going to derive is a formula, not for the absolute number of vacua, but more for from some sort of index where you count a vacua with signs, and that gives a lower bound on the number of vacua. So we're going to do it in the general F-theory setting, if you want, or just in the general case of, say, you have some superpotential of the form n alpha pi alpha, where the pi alpha satisfies some axioms, if you want, that you always get, for example, from periods of Calabi-Yau four-folds or combinations of periods of Calabi-Yau three-folds combined with this axiom delta from tau, and so on. So it's very general, depending on some moduli, and a k-theta potential given by minus logarithm of pi alpha. Okay, so this is always a general structure you get. And eta alpha beta is, again, some intersection form, right? Symmetric one. The fluxes have to satisfy some tadpole cancellation condition, again, less than L star, which in the case of, you know, F-theory compactifications, Calabi-Yau fourfolds, is given by the only characteristic of the fourfolds divided by 24. Yeah. And what we are going to compute is, so not, well, okay, the absolute number would be sum overall fluxes, then something enforcing the tadpole constraint. So that will be L star minus 1/2, then this n squared here. Theta is again the step function, right? Times an integral over the moduli space. Times delta function of dw, so we're going to count solutions of dw equals 0, and then times determinant factor, all combinations of derivatives and derivatives bars acting on w and w bar, right? So this is big determinant. So this would be an exact formula for the total number of factor, right? So you sum over all fluxes satisfying the constraint. This just counts the number of solutions, so dw equals 0. Now, that unfortunately turns out to be hard to compute in closed form because of these absolute value signs. So what do? To get rid of that problem, you just remove the absolute value signs. And that means that some vector are going to contribute to plus 1 and some at minus 1. So this is somewhat similar to well-known Witten index and so on, indices in general. And as is the case, you know, for those things, this can, in fact, be computed in closed form. So rather than n, we'll call this I of index. But it's a very good estimate for the total number of vacuum. It might maybe be off by a factor 1/3 or something. But given the huge degeneracy that degeneracies that we're dealing with, that's, in fact, totally insignificant. OK. Now, the main idea behind the computation is, yeah. No. So you can we computed this in cases, you know, in with few moduli where you can compute this and you get, you know, sort of 1/3 versus 2/3 or something. It's not 50-50 either, but it's not clear. It depends strongly on the Keeler potential and the details of the thing. So it's not there's not no as far as we know no universal balance or something like that. Yeah. Okay, so remember like how we computed this volume of the k-dimensional sphere. In the Busse-Polchinski case, we did this by this trick by turning the integral into a Gaussian. So we're going to try to do exactly the same thing here. It's only going to be a little bit more complicated. So how can we turn this into a Gaussian? Of course, well, in the approximation, obviously, we're going to make is again to change this sum into an integral. Yeah. Now this guy. Well, this is very similar to what we had before. And by this integration trick, you can write this as 1 over 2 pi I ds over s e to the s L star minus 1/2 n squared. Remember where we took this integration contour over the imaginary axis and circling 0 to the right. Yeah. So that turns this integral. Well, this part turns it into a Gaussian. Now we have this. Yeah. So what do we do with this delta function? Well, we want it into some Gaussian-like integral. And remember, this dw depends linearly on n. Yeah. So if you simply enforce this delta function constraint by a branch multiplier, then we're in business, right? So because dw, if you want, is not nothing but d pi alpha n alpha, right? Because of this thing, so you get here li di pi alpha n alpha plus its complex conjugate. Yeah. So you see, you get something exponential of something linear in n. Fine, good. So now we have only one take care of, and that's the determinant of d squared w. how are you going to turn that into a Gaussian? Well, by introducing fermionic variables. Right. So you can write this as integral over d and psi, d and psi bar, d and theta bar of psi I theta j d I d j phi alpha and alpha plus psi I bar theta j d I bar d j phi alpha and alpha plus its complex conjugate. Yeah, so that, you see, if you work out this integral, gives exactly this determinant. And again, now you get something that's exponential of something linear. And so you've reduced in this way the whole integral to some Gaussian ensemble with bosons n and lambda, and then fermions psi and theta, and then there's one interaction, fermion, fermion, boson. So you can proceed then by integrating out n. And so that turns, well, that turns this index into 1 over 2 pi I integral ds over s e to the s of star times some z of s, where then z of s equals so you do these Gaussian integrals and you get 2 pi over s k over 2. And then you get some mess, but no. Hold on, life will soon become sunny again. Di dj plus sidebar okay, and then here. Complex conjugates minus complex conjugates. And then this squared, and by this square I mean, you know, the contraction with eta alpha beta, right? It's the same square as this n squared. Or by eta alpha beta inverse. Yeah. Well, and then this has to be integrated over the fermions. So this looks still extremely awful, saying, like, well, how am I ever going to get something out of that? And but now there's actually the geometrical structure of this flux vacua that comes in, which is some form of special geometry, n equals 1 special geometry. I cannot quite get into the details, but it turns out that acting with these covariant derivatives on these periods actually typically makes them orthogonal to what they were before. So, and this is related to the fact that if you start, for example, with a holomorphic 4-0 form and you act with a covariant derivative 1s on it, you get a 3-1 form, which will be orthogonal to the 4-0 form and so on. So you get all these orthogonalities. And in fact, you can compute all the contractions of all these period derivatives in closed form, and the only non-zero ones, well, there's only, yeah, there's only a few non-zero ones. Anyway, if you do all that, you'll get the following relatively simple expression. So you get Zs equals integral over all these fermions. Of 1 over 2s, gij, lambda I, lambda j. So that's, you know, you get from the contraction of di pi with d bar, pi bar. and then you get some curvature. Of the metric on the moduli space. And then some metric terms. Anyway, let me skip over the details. You can work this out. It's not too much work. And then you can just perform the lambda integral, the theta integrals. And what you end up with, well, after then also doing the S integral, is this very nice formula. Integral over the moduli space, 1 over pi m. Determinant of r plus omega 1, where r is a curvature form on the moduli space. Omega is the Cayley form. And there you go. So you recognize here, you know, what we have seen many times before. This is basically the volume of this sphere of fluxes, which, you know, even though it's a priori an indefinite form here, this constraint, because of the supersymmetry constraint, becomes definite, positive definite. And that effectively gives indeed a sphere of radius L star, or square root of 2 L star. So that's this factor. And then the entire dependence indeed on the Calabi-Yau manifold is simply given by this expression. And this is very reminiscent of course, an order density, right? You get this curvature, and it is in fact the order density of the tangent bundle coupled then to the Cayley U1 bundle that you have in supergravity. And so this, in principle, you can compute. Now, in practice, it may still be quite involved, but nevertheless. So this gives them a very nice closed form for these numbers of vacua. And let me just end there. Thanks. Yeah, so this is, right. So you can, this is very general in F-theory. So these moduli are then actually complex structure moduli, D7 brain moduli as well. You can specialize this to the type 2B case. You get something that's essentially the same. But so, as I said, indeed, so this takes only into account the complex structure moduli sector. But that's where the main degeneracy comes from. So for the true total number of vacua, you would have to multiply this then by the number of vacua you get from the Cayley sector. And No. So the reason why, I mean, of course, the true reason why we left out the Cayley moduli is because, basically because of this. So you get this mass. You could do everything up to this point. But then it's this tremendous simplification that happens because all these contractions, actually, most of them are zero, and that the few that remain have a very nice geometrical expression. That enormous simplification is just not going to happen for the form of the Cayley potential, for the Cayley moduli, as we know it. Maybe people will find more elegant geometrical structures underlying those superpotentials as well, and then we might be in business to include those as well. But yeah. Right. Right. So, well, there are an infinite number of vacua. I mean, that is clear. So, for example, there are, I mean, an infinite number of Freund Rubin vacua, and even in type 2b, it turns out there are families of, well, there is in fact an infinite number of vacua. So the reason why this formula misses that is because it only takes into account this this computes the leading power of L star, but there could be, well, there are additional contributions that come with lower powers of L star, and they may in fact be infinite. Now, a similar thing, for example, happens in type 2a in this recent paper by De Wolf and Geryavets, Kachru, and Taylor, where they also find an infinite number of type 2a vacua. Now, all these infinite families have, it seems at this point, one thing in common, and is that they run away to infinite volume, for example. So in that sense, you could say, well, as long as I keep my domain of interest in the moduli space finite, then the number of vacua will be finite. At least at this point, all evidence is compatible with that. If I extend this domain up to, you know, the non-compact regions of the moduli space, like infinite volume and those things, I may get infinities, and it turns out you do get infinities. But the conjecture at this point is, as long as you consider a finite region, you get a finite number of vacua. Now, even that has not been established, so there may still be interesting things happening there. Now, is this a problem or not? Well, in some sense, it is a problem if you naively assumed that the probabilities of finding vacua were just proportional to the numbers. Because then, well, even if you exclude phenomenologically these vacua at very large volume, then, well, okay, you place a cutoff, you know, wherever you have observed, whatever we know for sure that the volume is definitely not bigger than. But then your prediction would be that, you know, the volume you will find at LHC or something will indeed be very large, like just larger than the thing we observed. And, well, who knows, maybe they will find large extra dimensions, but but yeah, this is indeed an indication that, you know, we're not computing probabilities, but numbers. So, yeah. Yep. Yeah. So that this indicates that we let's say it again, Matthew. Oh, yeah, in that sense. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that, you know, right, like comparing different caviars and so on, that would be hard to do. That would be the, yeah, so, well, actually, right, if that were your rule, like, you know, that you associate the biggest weight to the one with the biggest numbers of flux vacua. So at a certain point when k becomes too large, then this becomes small again. So it actually saturates at a certain value. And what you find for Calabi-Yau fourfolds typically is actually what determines, what really determines the total number of vacua is not so much the number of fluxes, but is the value of L star. So you find it actually saturates at some exponential value in L star. I think there is some bound. It's like bigger than something like e to the pi L star or something like that. So you would actually get the Calabi-Yau fourfold with the biggest chi over 24 that would be favored in that sense. It's not known if the number of Calabi-Yau fourfolds is finite. It's also not known if indeed chi is bounded from above and those things, but yeah, these are open questions. How did I get? Which? Oh, well, this follows, maybe Katrin Becker told something about it in her lecture. So there is an analogon of this D3 tadpole cancellation condition in M theory and F theory, which is the M2 tadpole cancellation condition. And that you can derive involves well, a negative contribution from the curvature that is precisely equal to the Euler characteristic of the fourfold divided by 24. I haven't derived that here, but you can look up that paper, for example. Questions? Oh, well. So you mean if the distribution is not proportional exactly to the numbers? That's right. Yeah. Well, there's people working on that. You know, for example, getting from this eternal inflation picture, getting some probability measure. Filenkin, for example, is thinking hard about that. And well, he keeps changing his mind about you know what the proper way of dealing with it is. The problem is you get like this fractal geometry, and it's very hard to you know, make sort of sense out of it. So there is not the, then there is the Hardle-Hawking proposal, like, you know, you basically it's saying that the probability of getting certain vacuum is proportional to e to the 1 over the cosmological constant. But that's a rather weak selection principle because it just selects, you know, it will just push it to the lowest possible cosmological constant. Apart from that, it don't tell you anything more. And in fact, you'll get then pretty simple, like for the rest, you'll get pretty similar distribution than this thing. So, yeah, at this point, we don't know, but. That's right. Yeah. Cancellation. This, oh yeah, so I drop the absolute values and then you may get cancellations. That's what kind? Well, like plus versus, yeah, so here now some of the zeros of this will contribute with +1 and some will contribute with -1, right? But unless there is like some amazing conspiracy that the number of pluses and minuses are almost exactly the same, you will get in the end a result that is of the same order as the absolute number, right? So say if 2/3 are pluses and 1/3 is a minus, well then you'll get the final result that is 1/3 of the absolute number. But given the, you know, like 1/3 of 10^355 is still 10^355, so it doesn't. Sorry, that. Right. Yeah, these are only yeah, so this is just for supersymmetric ones. Yeah, this can be done for non-supersymmetric ones as well, but it's more well, you don't get it in closed form just like that. Yeah. Yeah, so in the, right, so in the, for the non-supersymmetric case, you have to replace this by V prime with V the potential, and this by determinant of V double prime, right? The problem is then things are, you know, V is quadratic, and so you don't get this nice linear dependence anymore. Things get much more messy, and so this approach doesn't quite work anymore. What you still can do is this change of variables trick, and then you can, well, make some approximations, and you do in the end get to a distribution of supersymmetry breaking scales, but it's worked out in my well, one of my papers with Mike. It's relatively involved, but you get a universal result, which is sort of surprising because you wouldn't have expected universal power a priori. You would have expected some depends on the number of fluxes. It turns out that not depend on that. So maybe one other last interesting thing is that, which I didn't mention actually, is the appearance of this curvature here. So that means at points in the moduli space where the curvature blows up, for example, conifold points, you'll get a strong accumulation of vacua. So that's, you know, why various singularities, conifold points, and so on actually are vacuum attractors, which is another rather interesting phenomenon. Just
So the next, we'll have about a 15-minute break, and the next lecture will start at 3:30 until 5 p.m.